How are your New Year's resolutions coming along? Did you make any? How many people kind of spent a little bit of time? Nobody? I'll fess up. You'll hear me, my confessions in a moment. So, you know. It's estimated that 40% of Americans do, compared with 33% of Americans who watch the Super Bowl. So that is like a lot of people, right? That's a lot of people. And Dave's right. New Year's Day is an arbitrary day. And the majority of us ignore or resist using it as an artificial marker for embarking on some sort of self-improvement. But something, at least in some of us, invites us around New Year's, around our birthday perhaps, to take stock, to feel some kind of an itch for change, to consider how things might be done differently in our lives. And then the moment passes. And we find ourselves, sometimes against our better intentions, slipping back into patterns and behaviors that frustrate or even infuriate us. True confessions, I'm starting with my own. I instinctively started my own laundry list again early at the beginning of this month of all the ways that I could improve and do better. I need to sleep more. I need to get more exercise. I need to be more on top of my emails, spend more time with my family and friends, definitely get the desk, my desk clutter cleared up, write my first novel, and fly to the moon. So they say it takes about 27 days for a new habit to stick, which is in part why I picked this day, about 20 days after New Year's, the New Year's ball has dropped, to talk about resistance to change. And I thought, what a great metaphor, the dropping of the ball. I just thought about that as I was writing this. If you're among the many people who engage with resolutions, it's about this time that you've probably already thrown in the towel or are proudly transformed. And studies show that only 8% of us reach that satisfying moment of transformation. This year, it only took me till about January 5th to stop the folly in my head and to realize that my laundry list of self-improvement goals were actually contradictory. I can't really get more sleep and add all these new requirements to my life, all on one day's notice. So I had to choose. And in that frustration, I just dropped the whole thing. Reminding myself that I really am doing okay in this world. And that a messy desk is actually a sign of creative genius. Yes. Going back to being more gentle with myself rather than stern. And then resuming whatever patterns of behavior I found abhorrent just a few days before. Now, that's not totally satisfying, mind you, as rationalizations are never as tightly sealed as we would want them to be, and they can't really stave off the barrage of negativity that arises when a goal remains unmet. So some years, I've started off more gentle, writing newsletter columns about intentions instead of resolutions, and inviting myself into renewed orientations towards life rather than deliberate, tangible goals to attain. This, by the way, goes against every self-help book's recommendations. But for some things, it may be exactly the path that our reticent souls need to take. I found, for example, that having an intention towards an attitude of gratitude has made me happier and more thankful each and every day. And I've used various tools to attain that attitude of gratitude, to cultivate that intention. But there's no resolution about those tools the way I do it, just the intention to shift towards a more charitable attitude in life. So I've used journaling or walking or meditation to cultivate that in myself, or just noticing. Shortly after I dropped this year's set of resolutions, but not all the guilt around doing so, And actually, it was on January 12th exactly, a new question arose during my morning journaling. And it spoke more deeply to my core than any concrete cosmetic resolution that I had made. As I was journaling that morning, my pen formed these words: "What is your holy work this year?" And then it winnowed it down to this month, this week, this day. And then, because for me the word work often feels dogmatic and hard and full of shoulds and burdens, the question transformed itself into, "What is your holy dance this year?" Which offered me more graciousness and spaciousness within which to move. Now, whether it happens around this time of year, or every year on your birthday, or Arbor Day, or whatever day for that matter, a desire for inner change tends to be a part of our living beings. I've yet to meet a person who didn't have at least some little list in the back of their head about how they should change, what they should do better, if only, ... Author Stephen Pressfield writes, "Most of us have two lives, the lives we live and the unlived life within us. And between the two stands resistance. As powerful as our souls call," he says, "so potential are the forces of resistance arrayed against it. We're not alone if we've been mowed down by resistance." That gap where resistance lives is both a source of noticing and also a source of our suffering. It is that gap of our intention and our integrity and our wholeness. Living a life of more cohesion between our ideal self and what I'd call our standard operating procedures. Figuring out how to close that gap between those two parts of our inner landscape even just a little bit more can be quite empowering and integrating for our whole being. And certainly not easy to do. Remember that 8% number? I mean, that's just crazy. The odds are against us. Now, researchers Robert Keegan and Lisa Lasko Leahy have created a compelling theory about personal resistance. What they talk about the natural resistance to change as a sort of immune system with its positive purpose kind of ingrained in our DNA to protect us from the psychological trauma and danger that sudden change brings. So we naturally have this, don't change, it could be really bad, right? Because some sudden changes really do that to our system. But unfortunately, this same system that's meant to keep us wary of negative and disruptive changes can also inadvertently dissuade us from making the significant positive changes we need to make in our lives. Even the mere prospect of change can be enough to trigger that inborn defense mechanism, causing us to sabotage our best efforts before we've even begun. But my friends, there's hope. Their research invites us to go beyond the behavioral and technical approaches to change to what I would call the real soul work of change. The technical approach is, as starting tomorrow, I'm going to exercise every day for a half an hour. That's doomed to failure. Behind any desire for change, they say, are competing commitments. And these competing commitments are what's underneath the behaviors that you engage in that are keeping your patterns in place. So they use the example of a perfectionist whose goal is to work less hard and gain more balance in her life. The behavior shift to achieve that, she has decided, is to delegate more so she can ease up on her work hours. The pattern she noticed in herself was a lie that she told to herself and others When people would offer help, she'd say, "I'm almost done." And then she'd load her briefcase full of work and take it home. That lie is the behavior, but it points to a competing commitment underneath, a discomfort or fear that arises from the thought of shifting that pattern. So stay with me. The fears are that no one can do it as well for a perfectionist, and that delegating it would seem as a weakness. So the competing commitment is to be indispensable, necessary, and respected. Are you with me? So if you're just trying to work on the lie and you haven't really touched on that, you're going to keep lying. But scratch even further and you get into an even bigger big assumption, according to the researchers. These big assumptions are beliefs and internalized truths we hold about how the world works, how we work, and how people will respond to us. They are assumptions that make our hidden competing commitments necessary. They make them feel necessary. So for the perfectionist, it was, if I weren't admired and seen as essential, I'd just be average, and I'd cease to be special. That's a big assumption. And the researchers say, to make the change we need to make, we need to try experiments, even little ones, to shift those big assumptions, or to just see whether those big assumptions are really true. Not necessarily to prove it wrong, but to see how accurate it is, how accurate our natural don't change mechanism is to the real threats of our lives. Which of our behaviors that you've engaged in to protect yourself from worst-case scenarios are actually helpful, and which are actually counterproductive? The perfectionist, in their example, tried delegating a little bit more on less essential items and just seeing what happened. Just a little step. Whatever the outcome of the experiments, the researchers found that with diligent practice, these big assumptions can begin to morph and have less control over us, and our immunity to change can shift. But they said it takes like an hour a week for a few months. So that might be enough of a goal for me to, you know, back off of it. However, these big assumptions, as I was really looking at them, I've come to realize that the ones that keep us stuck are usually beliefs that we would have a hard time saying aloud. Beliefs that we'd try to talk our friends out of if we heard them saying them. Beliefs that might give us a, yuck, is that really what I think? Have you all seen my calendar and my to-do list? In my own inner work, one of my big assumptions is busy people are important. I think I've just bought into a whole cultural paradigm. Yuck. Yuck. And I think underneath these big assumptions, they get created to bolster up our sense of worthiness. Whether it's I have to do it myself or busy people are important, they're used to create an external facade of value in a culture that struggles to let us rest in our own inherent worth and dignity. Our own Unitarian Universalist value. If I'm not blank, then blank. And then the then after it is usually some sense of lack of some sense of worthiness or acceptance. If I'm not busy, then I'm not important. If I'm not smoking, well, then maybe for Dave. If I'm not smoking, particularly for a young adult, then I'm not cool. And if I'm not doing it all, I'm not special. No wonder it's so hard to change these patterns in our lives. These are core soul matters. So in addition to testing our assumptions with this real behavioral model, I find we also need to be gentle with those parts of ourselves that experience ourselves as lacking or as fundamentally flawed in some way, that we are somehow exempt from the inherent worth and dignity we espouse so graciously and effortlessly to others. We must learn to live in that paradox of being perfectly incomplete, whole and broken at the same time, worthy and in need of some repair, seeking wholeness and integrity, yet loving every part of ourselves and offering the same hope and grace to our brokenness that we would to one another. Perhaps this is our holy dance as Unitarian Universalists, honoring and centered in the inherent worth and dignity of all people. Perhaps this is our holy dance, not only with others, but with ourselves as well.